I next met with Dr. Jonathan Friedberg to obtain an update on lymphoma research. And to begin, we chatted about the historic ECOG Resort trial report at ASH on rituximab monotherapy. And to begin, I asked Dr. Friedberg about his non-protocol approach regarding this strategy.
The patient populations who would be eligible for our monotherapy are similar to those who are approached potentially with watch and wait. And I certainly do use our monotherapy in patients with follicular lymphoma. My current approach in a patient who has low tumor burden disease is to recommend watch and wait strategy. And there are really two things that happen if you observe patients. One is that they'll progress relatively quickly and declare themselves to, I think, benefit from chemotherapy with rituximab regimens. But the larger group of patients who has very slow progression, maybe months to years will go by before you need any intervention. When an intervention is necessary in that group, I think rituximab monotherapy is a very reasonable option.
So I actually interviewed Brad Call in the last issue of this series about his presentation of the ECOG Resort trial at ASH. Can you comment on these data?
So very briefly, the Resort trial is a very interesting randomized trial that looked at this group of low tumor burden patients with indolent lymphoma, patients who did not require treatment based upon formal criteria, and randomized them to two therapy approaches. So the first thing that happened is that these patients were given rituximab just weekly times four doses, and then responding patients were randomized to either rituximab maintenance given once every 3 months continuously until progression, and that could be for many years. And the other strategy was rituximab weekly times four again at time of progression. And the primary endpoint in comparing these two strategies was time to failure of rituximab, when the disease progressed through a rituximab-based treatment. So over 500 patients were enrolled, and the presentation that was made at ASH were limited to the subgroup of patients who had follicular lymphoma. I believe there are over 100 patients with other histologies that are going to be presented later. And the findings of the Resort trial were that both groups had reasonably long progression-free survivals, and there was no difference in failure of rituximab with the two different strategies. One important finding in my mind was that at about 3 years, close to half of patients in both groups did have some evidence of progression through rituximab, suggesting to me that there are really two groups of patients with low tumor burden indolent lymphoma, a group who's going to have very long benefit from rituximab and a group that has benefit that we might expect in about the 3 year range or less. There was a slight benefit as far as time to chemotherapy beginning in the continuous maintenance arm of the trial. But ultimately, the conclusions that were made by the ECOG group were that these strategies were quite similar, both were active, but there was more rituximab used in the maintenance arm and slightly more toxicity. So they favored the scheduled retreatment approach rather than the maintenance approach.
So one of the issues that I've heard people talk about is looking at the data in the control arm where they only got four doses of rituximab and then, you know, going out, I guess, overall to almost 4 years of progression-free. And I guess a lot of them were treated with rituximab again when they got progression. Seems like a pretty good outcome for a pretty short, relatively non-toxic treatment. And I've heard people say that now they're thinking more about R as opposed to watch and wait. What do you think about those thoughts?
I think it's not an unreasonable conclusion from the study that this group of patients, many of these patients have very durable benefit with a low toxicity intervention like single agent rituximab. Again, we really still don't know whether you're changing the natural history of these patients by giving them rituximab early versus waiting up to a few years until their disease progresses slowly to potentially benefit from treatment. So I'm not sure that the Resort trial itself should be a strong database to endorse early intervention with rituximab, but if you decide with a patient to give rituximab early, I think you can expect a very good outcome in many patients.
Now, I know it kind of was, you know, a different design, but another trial that people bring up when they talk about rituximab monotherapy is the so-called SAC approach. Could you explain what that is, what they saw, and how it affects your practice, if at all?
And in fact, it really affects my practice, and I'm glad you brought this up because I think that the challenge that I have in interpreting resort is to reconcile it with the SAC results. And the SAC results, this was a trial that was conducted in 1998, so it's a very old trial. And the reason why people are talking about it is that we now have 10-year follow-up of this trial. And this study enrolled patients with a variety of histologies of lymphoma, but we'll focus on the patients again with follicular lymphoma. And it included patients both with newly diagnosed disease as well as relapsed disease who were rituximab naive. And it simply randomized patients to two schedules of rituximab. One was rituximab weekly times four, and the other was rituximab weekly times four, followed by four doses of rituximab 2 months apart. Some call that maintenance, some call that extended schedule. It's really eight doses of rituximab versus four doses of rituximab. And the preliminary results were published in 2004 and showed that you could double the time to progression with the group who got the eight doses of rituximab. And it was one of the first studies that sort of endorsed the approach of giving rituximab on a more extended schedule with progression-free survival as the endpoint. The interesting results that have been published more recently is 10-year follow-up. And what I found fascinating was that that benefit was durable over 8 to 10 years. And in the small group of patients with newly diagnosed disease who were treated this way, 45% of those patients at 8 years to 9 years of follow-up still had not progressed after the eight doses of rituximab. And there was even a borderline survival advantage, not statistically significant, but a clear trend in the group who got eight doses versus four doses of rituximab. And those results certainly were hypothesis generating for me to suggest that if you're using rituximab single agent, that giving it on a more prolonged schedule may have different mechanisms that provide further durability. Now, that wasn't formally studied in the resort trial, but I think it does suggest to me that if you're using single-agent rituximab, there may be some benefit to at least some extended schedule. And what I've been doing, trying to reconcile resort with the SAC schedule, is that if I'm treating a patient with single-agent rituximab, I use the SAC schedule, which is eight doses, and then I stop. And I don't feel at all concerned that giving more maintenance makes a difference based upon the ECOG results.
You know, when you think about it, kind of it is hard to justify the two trials results. Is it something about the design or the type of patient, or how do you justify this?
Well, the patients are different, and I think the important difference is that in the resort trial, when patients progressed, they were given rituximab again. And in a sense, that might be another way of giving rituximab over an extended period of time. If you're following patients closely with a CT scan and you pick up a small lymph node that is growing from 2 to 2.5 or 3 centimeters, and you call that a progression and you give the patient rituximab again, it's almost like a prolonged maintenance type of treatment. It's just being done in a slightly different manner.
So the people in the SAC trial didn't necessarily get R on progression?
That's correct.
Okay, well, that kind of makes sense. Another data set that you were involved that reported at ASH that had been much anticipated, although I would never really was sure exactly why, because I wasn't sure how it was going to be interpreted when it got reported, was the SWOG study looking at iodine-131 tocetumumab with along with CHOP-R as part of initial management of patients with FL. Can you talk about that study, what it showed, and what you think it meant?
Sure. So I think the audience all is aware that the addition of rituximab to chemotherapy has provided significant benefit in follicular lymphoma, with certainly evidence of progression-free survival benefit and suggestions of overall survival benefit. And although there are numerous chemotherapy regimens that are used, certainly one of the most commonly used regimens is the R-CHOP regimen. The Southwest Oncology Group has been interested in combining different antibodies with chemotherapy for follicular lymphoma. And back in 1999, ran a trial of CHOP without rituximab times 6, followed by iodine-131 tocetuzumab radioimmunotherapy consolidation for patients with follicular lymphoma. And the outcome of that trial remains the best outcome that has ever been observed in cooperative group studies in follicular lymphoma in the United States. With 10-year follow-up, many of those patients still have not progressed, and it provided a great deal of enthusiasm among the investigators in SWOG to see if that regimen could hold its own against R-CHOP. So the SWOG-0016 trial, which is the one that was just presented at ASH a couple of months ago, enrolled patients over about a 7-year time period and randomized them initially to 3 arms, CHOP alone, R-CHOP, and the R-CHOP in that study was given in the original publication of Dr. Chutchman, so it was a couple of doses of rituximab intermixed with the CHOP that may or may not be important. And then the third arm was CHOP followed by iodine-131 tocetuzumab. After the first year, when data was coming out that R-CHOP was better than CHOP, the CHOP alone arm was dropped. So essentially, this was a head-to-head study of R-CHOP versus CHOP followed by iodine-131 tocetuzumab.
So just to interrupt there for a second, at that point when the arm was closed, was there any consideration of adding R into the other arm that was getting the radioimmunotherapy?
We have had a lot of discussions about that and continue to. At the time, there was concern based on some murine models in Seattle that if you gave a lot of rituximab prior to radioimmunotherapy, that it would compete with binding sites and may limit the efficacy of radioimmunotherapy. So it was actually a decision made based on some laboratory data to hold the rituximab in the group who got the radioimmunotherapy. Just to fast forward, we have subsequently conducted a phase 2 trial where we added the rituximab to the radioimmunotherapy, both as part of induction and maintenance, but those results are still pending.
And maybe you can talk about what was seen in this trial.
So the first thing is that the reason why it took so long for this presentation to get out there was because the event rate was much less than expected. And I think one of the important conclusions is that both arms of this study did very, very well and better than we anticipated when we put the study together. That having been said, when you look at progression-free survival and overall survival, there was no difference between the two arms. And if you look at the Kaplan-Meier curves, they are really overlying each other. There doesn't appear to be even any trend on a difference. There were some mild toxicity differences, as would be expected. There was slightly more neutropenia in the group who got rituximab, and in the group who got radioimmunotherapy, there was some hypothyroidism, which you expect, as well as HAMA, or human anti-mouse antibody formation, the clinical significance of which is unclear. There were some cases of MDS-AML in the radioimmunotherapy arm, and there were a couple of toxic deaths on the radioimmunotherapy arm.
So kind of what does this mean and what's the next step in terms of trials?
Well, I think that for people who were hoping that radioimmunotherapy would show a benefit, this was disappointing. And it was particularly disappointing because in the R-CHOP arm, there was no rituximab maintenance. And we know from PRIMA that we can improve upon R-CHOP, at least as far as progression-free survival, by adding rituximab maintenance. So I think even if the study were positive, the bar was high. But now with the study essentially being negative with no difference, there really, in my mind, is not a clear role to use radioimmunotherapy consolidation if you're going to use rituximab in your induction regimen.
What about from a trial perspective? What's the study you all are going to do next or are doing?
So we have completed a phase two study that added the rituximab, as I mentioned, to both induction and maintenance. That's the S0801 trial. That accrued very quickly, and we're just going to need to wait probably a few years to see if there's any signal of benefit. But I think our group has moved away from exploring radioimmunotherapy as an important modality in the upfront treatment of follicular lymphoma.
Now, this phase two study is R chemo followed by RAI followed by R maintenance?
That's right. And the R maintenance is actually 4 years of maintenance. So it's a 5-year treatment plan.
I mean, it sounds like kind of an appealing approach intuitively.
I think the physicians that enrolled within a year, about 100 patients, and people were very excited about the concept. I'm running that trial, and I get the data sheets, and all I can tell you is that almost everybody has gone on to maintenance, suggesting that the response rate has been extremely high.
What about the issue of radioimmune therapy upfront, period? You know, we had the series that Mark Kaminsky, he was actually co-author on the SWOG study also. There have been other series reported. What do we know about that? Is that an option? You know, are there, you know, older patient or any situation where you think it would be an option?
I think that the data that's out there is still limited, and probably there should be more data out there than there is. And I'm not exactly sure, if you look back over the last 10 years, why more groups and people haven't explored this. But Mark Kaminsky's study showed that at Michigan, in a group of about 70 patients that he treated, a single institution, but a group that did have representation of all FLIPI scores, that a single dose of iodine-131 tocilizumab resulted in a very impressive 4 to 5 year event-free survival rate. And many of those patients remain in remission. So clearly, it's a very active drug, and many patients can have prolonged benefit from the drug. The other important study that we have out there that looks at radioimmunotherapy is the so-called FIT trial, which took patients treated with a variety of different regimens and randomized them to ibrutumumab tiuxetan radioimmunotherapy consolidation versus observation. And the group who got the consolidation had a very prolonged progression-free survival. Longer-term follow-up of that study was presented at ASH last year and suggested, though, that there were increased numbers of MDS and AML in the group who got ibrutumumab tiuxetan. So I think where we're going with this is that I certainly hope radioimmunotherapy doesn't go away. I think it's an important tool in our toolbox. It's one of the most active single agents. But I don't think we have compelling evidence yet that giving radioimmunotherapy upfront changes the natural history or distinguishes itself over several other very active modalities, including the ways that we talked about just before with rituximab monotherapy. And many of the patients who Mark Kaminsky treated in his study may have been eligible for the RESORT trial. So I'm concerned because with the series of negative studies that the enthusiasm to study radioimmunotherapy more upfront certainly is less. But I think defining its role in the relapse setting remains to be done. I tend to use it in patients as a consolidation approach in the relapse setting who are older and may not be eligible for more aggressive consolidation approaches like autologous transplant.
Do you think that radioimmune therapy is utilized more by investigators than docs in practice? And if so, you know, we're talking about this sort of how these two groups see things. And if you think there's a difference, how come?
Well, I think the answer is absolutely yes. But I think that even the investigators haven't used it very much. If you get statistics on the number of patients treated outside of clinical trials with radioimmunotherapy commercially, it's a very small number of patients each year. It's under 1,000 patients. So I think that there are logistical issues. Radioimmunotherapy is not available in every hospital. And there's some scheduling issues and so forth that clearly it's easier for me to arrange radioimmunotherapy than it might be for an oncologist in practice in the community. I also think that if you haven't been exposed to radioimmunotherapy and done it a few times, it's something new and people tend to do what they're comfortable doing. And if you have four or five options, you're more likely to give chemotherapy or give rituximab, which is something that you're more comfortable doing.
I've been kind of curious for years why it's not used more. I'm still not sure I've figured it out. Do you think that there's an increased risk of MDS from radioimmune therapy in the absence of using chemo, for example, like in these upfront kind of situation?
I think there is a slight risk. And I think that, you know, it's radiation treatment. And interestingly, in the SWOG 9911 trial, the pilot trial, there was no MDS reported. And that we thought was evidence that if you give radioimmunotherapy early, you don't have to worry about MDS. Well, in fact, in the 0016 trial, we did see a couple of cases of MDS. Not enough to be statistically significant yet, but I think it suggests that, at least with a limited amount of chemotherapy, radioimmunotherapy certainly adds to some risk. The monotherapy study, I think Mark Kaminsky may have told me that he has seen one case, but it could have been that that patient went on and got additional treatment. So
yeah, that was my understanding, that the patient had got a transplant or whatever.
Right. I personally believe there's a small risk. I think there's a risk with other agents, and for all we know, drugs like bendamustine and other drugs that people are using a lot of may have similar risks.
What do we know about radioimmune therapy in mantle cell?
So radioimmunotherapy in mantle cell has been studied in a relatively small number of trials. The Memorial Sloan Kettering Group did an interesting trial where they gave iodine-131 tocilizumab first and then CHOP chemotherapy in mantle cell lymphoma. And then Mitch Smith in the ECOG group sort of did the opposite. They gave abbreviated R-CHOP and then ibritumumab-tiuxetan consolidation. Both of those studies together suggest that there is some benefit to radioimmunotherapy on top of what you would expect with R-CHOP alone. With R-CHOP alone, you expect most patients to have progression with mantle cell lymphoma within 18 months to 2 years. If you add the radioimmunotherapy in the ECOG study, I believe it pushed that progression-free survival out to about 30 months.
So I want to try to get to your cases in a minute, but first a few more things in terms of recent pubs that you've had and that maybe you can comment on, which is the whole arena of new drugs, particularly ones that, you know, maybe oncologists are going to be seeing in their practice. And one that we heard some about at ASH, and you were on one of these papers, was GA101. What is it and what do we know about it?
So GA101, I think the other name for it is obinutuzumab.
I didn't want to try that.
Okay. It's a wise choice. I'll call it GA101 as well. This is a third generation anti-CD20 monoclonal antibody. And there are more than a dozen of these new anti-CD20 monoclonal antibodies that are in various stages of development that are all hoping to show benefit over rituximab. Of course, we have one that's been approved, ofatumumab, and that's being used in a small subset of patients with CLL. But this molecule, GA101, is designed to be better than rituximab in several ways. It's a humanized antibody, so in theory, there may be some less toxicities associated with it that are probably not relevant for patients with lymphoma, but could be relevant for autoimmune and other indications. I think the biggest difference between GA101 and the other monoclonal antibodies like rituximab is that GA101 is a type 2 monoclonal antibody. It's a different class. And what that essentially means, the way I think about it, is that when this antibody binds to CD20, different events happen. And it increases the likelihood, a type 2 antibody does, of direct cell death. So the hope is that even in a patient who may be resistant to type 1 antibodies, that the type 2 antibody may have an increased activity. And what's been observed in patients treated with GA101 is in small numbers of patients in phase 1 and early phase 2 trials, patients who had had rituximab before and even exhibited some resistance to rituximab before have responded to GA101. So the study that we presented at ASH this year in a preliminary form was designed in a phase two situation to compare GA101 with rituximab head-to-head. Now, importantly, this is in a group of rituximab-sensitive patients. You wouldn't want to enroll rituximab-resistant patients on a study where you had a 50% chance of getting rituximab. And the primary endpoint of this was response rate. And the response rate, ultimately, of GA101 was higher than the response rate of rituximab in this situation. I should emphasize that in addition to an upfront dosing schedule, there was maintenance built into the study in both arms. Now, the response rate was high enough that it really met the goals of the study. However, when we looked at progression-free survival, there was absolutely no difference between the two arms, which to me was somewhat disappointing because I would have expected with an improved response rate, a longer progression-free survival in the GA101 arm. And I think it suggests an important concept that all people need to consider is that we've historically used response rates as surrogates for progression-free survival and clinical benefit. But in a treatment program that includes maintenance, where activity of the drug might include stability of disease, and even having disease is asymptomatic, you may not be able to correlate a response rate to a progression-free survival benefit.
Where do you see things heading for this agent?
Well, despite perhaps the disappointing result in progression-free survival, the company is pursuing three very large randomized phase three trials to really determine whether this drug may beat rituximab. These studies are being done in upfront follicular lymphoma, relapsed follicular lymphoma, and upfront diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And they're anticipating a bold international goal of enrolling more than 2,000 patients on these trials.
So continuing along the idea of new agents, maybe you can comment on the new small molecules inhibiting the B-cell receptor pathway, CAL101, Bruton tyrosine kinase inhibitors, and SYK inhibitors that you reported on.
So I think the agents that are perhaps the most promising and are at least garnering a lot of enthusiasm from investigators are these agents that target members of the B-cell receptor pathway. And of course, every B cell has an immunoglobulin on its surface. And that pathway involves numerous elements. And when that pathway is stimulated, that confers a survival signal to the B cell. In the case of malignant lymphomas, certainly a subset of these lymphomas appear to be particularly reliant on the survival signal. And abrogation of the survival signal can result in cell death. And several small molecules have been developed and shown to have very high response rates and very promising activities in subsets of lymphoma. We published a few years ago evidence that inhibiting SYK, SYK, or spleen tyrosine kinase, had response rates in various subsets of lymphoma. And I'm happy to say that finally that drug is moving forward in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, with a lot of correlative studies and a phase two study to try to determine the subgroup of patients with large cell lymphoma who may respond. At this ASH meeting, there was very impressive data looking at an inhibitor of BTK or Bruton's tyrosine kinase, another pathway member, in mantle cell lymphoma, suggesting a response rate that exceeded 60%. This is an oral agent. It's extremely well tolerated. You know, minimal GI distress, but no hair loss, no nausea, no vomiting. You can take this chronically, and it doesn't appear to confer a lot of immunosuppression either.
So last question about new agents before we get to your cases. Got to ask you about brentuximab vedotin. I don't know how much Hodgkin lymphoma you see, but I know you see anaplastic large cell. Can you talk a little bit about what we know about this agent, what's been reported recently, and where you think things are heading?
I do care for patients with Hodgkin lymphoma and, in fact, was involved in the pivotal study of brentuximab vedotin as well as the expanded access program. And I can say that essentially brentuximab vedotin is like rituximab was when it came out for B-cell malignancies. It is an amazingly active agent. And I've seen many patients who really had no other therapeutic options and were approaching hospice care have remarkable turnaround in their performance status with this agent and durability of response that's quite impressive. I have one patient with relapse refractory Hodgkin's who had disease come back after an autologous transplant. He was treated on the pivotal study with this agent. That was more than 3 years ago, and his disease remains perfectly controlled.
As long as you're talking about this issue of post-autologous transplant and relapse, what about the data looking at B-vedotin as a bridge to allo transplant?
So that's a very good question. So the brituximab vedotin for Hodgkin lymphoma, the pivotal study and the label is for relapsed after autologous transplant. And essentially, in this group of patients, when patients relapse after autologous transplant, which despite the fact autologous transplant is the standard treatment, happens more than 50% of the time that people will relapse after an autologous transplant. And many of the higher risk patients have a reasonably high chance of relapsing after autologous transplant. So it's a real problem for the small subset of patients with Hodgkin lymphoma who need an autologous transplant. Many of these patients are very young. Hodgkin lymphoma, the median age is 29. So there has been a lot of enthusiasm to try to use other aggressive methods to obtain definitive disease control. And I think in many centers, the default historically was if you relapse after an autologous transplant, you should go on to allogeneic transplant. So now enter brentuximab vedotin, where we have suddenly a single agent that's well tolerated that you can get at least for up to 1 year with a response rate of 70 to 80% and a CR rate that is about half that number. And the question is, if you see somebody after an autologous transplant who relapses with Hodgkin lymphoma and they respond briskly to brituximab vedotin, should you go right to allo or should you ride out brituximab vedotin for as long as possible? And this is a real problem because we don't know the right answer. And I can tell you we've encountered it in our clinic at least 5 times over the last calendar year. And essentially, if you look at the data carefully, if you obtain a CR to brituximab vedotin, those patients do quite well for very long periods of time. And what we've been doing, and this is simply our approach locally, is that if patients obtain a CR to brituximab vedotin, we are continuing that therapy and holding the allotransplant for perhaps sometime in the future. If you don't respond or you only achieve a PR, those are patients who are unlikely to have durable disease control. And if you're thinking of allogeneic transplant in those patients, you may want to proceed relatively quickly.
Maybe we should take a step back, and I'm curious about your comments in terms of sort of what B-vedotin is. I mean, it's an antibody-drug conjugate, and specifically about the CD30 antigen and where it's seen.
Yeah, so CD30 is present on virtually all cases of Hodgkin lymphoma. Subsets of T-cell lymphomas, including, as you said, anaplastic large cell lymphoma, which is really defined as being CD30 positive. But then other peripheral T-cell lymphomas, about 10 to 20% of them may have CD30 on their surface. And importantly, and perhaps not well recognized, is that a subset of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma also expresses CD30. And we actually, just out of interest, had a tissue microarray that we were using for some of the SWOG trials. And I asked them, you know, in the most recent SWOG trial, what was the percentage of patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma who were CD30 positive? And I think it was about 17% or something like that. So there is a subset of patients with B-cell disease that also express CD30.
How do you feel about if you could get it paid for using B-vedotin in a patient with a CD30 positive tumor that's not within the labeled indication? Are we going to need a trial for each one of these things, or are we just going to start treating based on CD30?
Well, I think for T-cell lymphomas, personally, I would strongly consider using brituximab vedotin in a patient who had a CD30 positive T-cell lymphoma. the categorization of anaplastic T-cell lymphoma versus a CD30-positive peripheral T-cell lymphoma is honestly somewhat arbitrary. And to me, seeing the data that we've seen in anaplastic T-cell lymphoma would make me comfortable in any T-cell lymphoma that's CD30-positive. I think on the B-cell lymphoma side, I would feel a little more comfortable with a trial. But I think it's a trial that really should be done. As my understanding is that Seattle Genetics does have a study open that is sort of just open to any CD30-positive malignancy, and we should be getting some data. And it won't take much data, I think, to make me very enthusiastic to try it.
And I guess the other thing that's kind of interesting, if I understand this correctly, is that within Hodgkin lymphoma, it's really just the Reed-Sternberg cells that have the overexpression?
That's right.
It's kind of interesting. Can you talk a little bit about sort of what the theory is about what else is in the tumor besides Reed-Sternberg and, you know, how that comes about?
Well, we know a lot about Hodgkin lymphoma, and there's a lot that we don't know about Hodgkin lymphoma. I mean, everybody's aware that if you look under a microscope, in many cases, Hodgkin lymphoma is challenging to diagnose because for every diagnostic Reed-Sternberg cell, which is the Hodgkin lymphoma cell, there are maybe hundreds of surrounding normal cells, B cells, T cells, eosinophils, macrophages, and so forth. And in fact, it's very possible that a lot of our chemotherapy effect on Hodgkin lymphoma is not to kill the Reed-Sternberg cell, but to simply eradicate the surrounding infiltrate, which may be necessary somehow to keep the Reed-Sternberg cells alive. So you're correct that what's interesting about brituximab vedotin is that largely this is not a treatment targeting the microenvironment. It is targeting the tumor cell, and that may be why it's so efficacious.
Maybe you can comment a little bit on the peripheral neuropathy that's seen with this agent.
So that's a very real problem, and I don't think that we want to give the message to people who are using this drug that it's like giving rituximab for Hodgkin lymphoma. This, as you mentioned, is an antibody drug conjugate. The drug is a tubulin agent, and not surprisingly, neurotoxicity can be a problem. And most patients do very well, but there's a small number of patients who develop fairly severe neuropathy. And I had one patient who was on one of the original studies, and I perhaps didn't recognize this as a toxicity as soon as I should have. And he had a fairly severe neurologic compromise that lasted for months before it improved. So I think similar to any other agents that we give that have neurotoxicity, before each dose, you have to assess the patients. And if you see neurotoxicity, there are dose modifications that are recommended in the label.
And in terms of the issue of upfront therapy, what do we know about that? There was a really interesting presentation by Dr. Yunus at ASH looking at this.
So obviously, when you have a very active agent that, as a single agent, probably has the highest response rate of any drug in Hodgkin lymphoma, we want to try to move it up front so more patients can benefit. And a few institutions got together and simply piloted adding brituximab vedotin to the ABVD regimen. And initially, what they found was an increased pulmonary toxicity that they felt was secondary to the combination of bleomycin and brituximab vedotin. The rate of pulmonary toxicity was as high as 40%. I will remind people that these patients were probably watched closer than most of the patients we treat with ABVD, and there is a known rate of pulmonary toxicity with bleomycin anyway. But nevertheless, they elected to drop bleomycin and essentially replace bleomycin with brituximab vedotin. And when they treated patients that way, they did not see the pulmonary toxicity. And in a single-arm study, they have a response rate that's very, very high, suggesting at least that this is a regimen that could move forward in a randomized trial.
Is that going to happen?
Yes. The company is actually planning to sponsor a global randomized study comparing ABVD to a brituximab vedotin VD. The cooperative groups in the United States are in final stages of discussions planning our next intergroup study in advanced stage Hodgkin lymphoma. And I am certain that brituximab vedotin will be part of that.
And certainly at this point, combining bleomycin and bevacizumab is contraindicated. What about a patient who's had bleo in the past?
So people ask that a lot, and we have to remember that I think every patient that's been treated with brituximab vedotin on the clinical trials have had bleomycin in the past, because whether you use ABVD up front or Bayacop or even Stanford 5, all of these regimens have bleomycin. So it certainly appears to be safe if somebody's had bleomycin in the past. We don't know the time point or a washout period that is safe, and it's simply the observation made that you can't give the two drugs together.
So you prepared several cases, but we had a lot to talk about. So how about if you just present your 80-year-old man?
This is a patient who presented with weakness, weight loss, and splenomegaly. He finally had some imaging done that showed diffuse lymphadenopathy, including evidence of some vertebral body abnormality, suggesting bone involvement. And a bone marrow aspirate and biopsy showed clear evidence of mantle cell lymphoma, both with a characteristic immunophenotype of CD5 positive, CD23 negative. It was cyclin D1 positive, and a FISH study was done which showed the 1114 translocation. So we spoke to him about the best treatment options for him. And at age 80, there is not a big data set to really guide us in what the best treatment option is for mantle cell lymphoma. But for most elderly patients, I've moved to using bendamustine rituximab as a backbone of treatment for mantle cell lymphoma. The planned intergroup trial in mantle cell lymphoma for the older patients will be using bendamustine and rituximab as a backbone and adding drugs to that regimen. So our plan was to give him 6 cycles of bendamustine and rituximab. And I think the second issue that comes up in his case is whether he should get rituximab maintenance or not.
What are you thinking?
So there's one data set from Germany that was a 2x2 randomized trial that basically suggested in a subset of patients who were treated initially with R-CHOP that giving rituximab maintenance can prolong progression-free survival substantially compared to interferon maintenance. And it would be a couple of extrapolations in somebody who's getting a different induction regimen, bendamustine rituximab, and since the German trial wasn't placebo-controlled, to give rituximab maintenance. That having been said, in an 80-year-old, where salvage options are really quite limited and obviously autologous and allogeneic transplants are off the table, my goal in him is to really try to keep the disease away for as long as possible. And he's done beautifully through at least the first 5 cycles of bendamustine and rituximab. We just gave him the 6th cycle yesterday, and he was eager to finish. That I'm leaning toward recommending at least consideration of maintenance if he's interested in that approach.
And if I understand it correctly, that ECOG study that you talk about in the older or non-transplant situation, everybody's getting R maintenance, and then the randomization is to adding lenalidomide?
That's correct. And I think that suggests that at least the ECOG group felt that this data from Germany was compelling enough that the, quote, standard arm should include rituximab maintenance.